Mic one, testing with mic one. Testing with mic one. Testing with mic two. Testing with mic two. Testing with mic two. This is an interview with John D. Ferry of the Chemistry Department. We're talking on the 25th of October, 1985, in his office in the Chemistry Building. I'm Laura Smale. The interview is being done for the University Archives Oral History Project. Testing mic two. Try, you ought to make sure that you're recording. That looks fine. I've made an introductory statement on the tape, and I would now like you to talk about your family.
Yes. My father grew up partly in Chicago and partly in San Diego, California. His father and one of his uncles had ranches in San Diego County. He attended high school at the Armour Institute in Chicago, and spent summers in Southern California. Then his parents settled permanently in San Diego, and his father was a county official for 25 years in San Diego County.
What period are we talking about?
We're talking about 1900 to 1925.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so this is your life also then?
Well, oh yes.
Yes.
My mother grew up, was born in northern Michigan, grew up there and in Toledo, Ohio. Her father manufactured dynamite. I don't know the details of his business, but somewhat interestingly, now that I am here, my mother's grandfather settled in the village of Ryo, Wisconsin, and was the first postmaster and first druggist there in the middle of the 19th century. So I have some Wisconsin ties.
Oh, interesting.
Through that. Both my parents graduated from Stanford University, my mother having also moved to Southern California with her mother and settled in Los Angeles.
Now, that was unusual for a woman at that time, was it?
I really don't know. Mm. She was a widow, and I don't really know the reason for their having moved to
California. But I mean that your mother went to Stanford at that time. Perhaps not.
Well, no, I don't think so. When the university was founded, it was co-educational, although the number of women was limited to 400 for a long time. I might mention something about that later. My father graduated in civil engineering. My mother graduated in classics. And after graduation, my father took a job with the Yukon Gold Company in Dawson, in the Yukon. My mother taught high school. She had learned, of course, Latin and Greek, and she also knew German very well, and I think she taught mostly German in high school. My father became really more of a mining engineer in his career, since his first job was with the Yukon Gold Company. My mother went in, as they used to say, to the Yukon Territory in 1911. That was 2 years after my father had gone there, and they were married in Dawson. This was necessary because a woman could not make the trip into the gold mining area in the winter, and my father couldn't come out in the summer because that was the mining season.
Couldn't go in because it was just too rugged too difficult.
It was far too rugged a trip. It was in the winter. It could only be done by horse-drawn sleigh,
yeah,
with many, many changes, many days overnight stops at places which wouldn't be appropriate for a woman to stay in. I should say something about the mining operations, perhaps. This was 10 years after when my father went into the Yukon Territory. It was 10 years after the big gold rush, and Dawson City had quieted down to some extent from the early wild gold rush days. There was a certain amount of social life associated with the fact that it was the headquarters of the British government for the Yukon Territory. People dressed for dinner, although they would sometimes bring their evening clothes to the host's house and change there because in the winter it was too cold to go out in that kind of costume. It was a terribly rugged life, keeping warm in the winter. And my mother, in her 80s, wrote a book about her experiences there, which is called Yukon Gold.
And under what name did she write it?
Eudora B. Ferry.
It'd be fun to read.
Yes, people have found it quite interesting. The mining operations were on a very large scale. It was mostly gold dredging of alluvial deposits, and I think at the time that they left the north, my father was in charge of the thawing operations for all the dredges, of which the Yukon Gold Company had about a dozen, I think. The ground had to be thawed before it could be dug up, and this was done by injecting steam through pipes, an enormous operation, considering the magnitude of the amount of ground that had to be handled. I was born in 1912. I'll inject a few humorous notes. I have the title of sourdough because I have seen the ice go out of the Yukon River in the spring, which was the great event, because steamers could not come in and bring supplies from the outside. Again, we have this terminology of the inside and the outside.
Yeah.
They couldn't come in until the ice had gone out. Of course, I don't remember. Before you're a sourdough, you're a chichaco.
A what?
A person who has not seen the ice go out in the spring is a chichaco.
How do you spell it?
Chechako.
Sounds Indian.
Perhaps many people know the poems of Robert Service, such as The Shooting of Dan McGrew. He has one book entitled Ballads of a Chichaco and another Songs of a Sourdough. He was living in Dawson at the time my parents were there. My parents left to spend some time outside in August of 1914. In fact, the war broke out while we were on shipboard. I was 2 years old. And although they had planned to return, when they went back to San Diego, my father's home, they in the end decided not to, that it was just too rugged a life. And my father, for a brief period, changed his profession and tried commercial advertising. he was a rather good artist, especially with cartoons. He'd been editor of the College Humor magazine at Stanford, but this turned out not to be a successful profession, so he went back into mining, and for a number of years was associated with mining operations in California.
Did your mother go on teaching?
No, she never went back to teaching. When I was 4 and a half, my twin sisters were born, and my mother didn't have much time for me, as might be expected, especially since my father was out on gold mining operations much of the time. We were living in Berkeley then, and I taught myself to read and write by the time I was 5, so I was reading quite avidly everything I could get my hands on.
Do you remember that, doing it?
Oh yes. One of my favorites was Kipling's Jungle Book, I also read a child's magazine which was called John Martin's Book, and I've always remembered one of the first things I saw in there. It said, "Read the best books first, or you may not have a chance to read them at all." A quotation from Thoreau, I believe. advice which I've never forgotten.
Yes. Do you remember teaching yourself to read and write?
I don't remember exactly how I did it, unfortunately. Mm. But I taught myself both to read and write. Well, when I was 6, my father became resident manager of a gold mining operation in northern Idaho, in a very remote place. And we spent the next 8 or 9 years there. I went back to the village of Murray. It was hardly a village. I think the population was 100 or 200 when we lived there. I went back last summer, 1984, and realized even more from this visit what an isolated and difficult life it must have been, especially for my mother. Mm. We were snowed in from November until May, and the only way to get out of the place was by horse-drawn sleigh, so that over 2 mountain passes, it was almost an all-day trip. Yeah. So if somebody was sick, it was a very difficult decision whether to go to the doctor or not. I can remember one of my sisters at the age of 2 having broken her arm, and nobody was absolutely sure whether it was broken or whether she would have to make the trip. She did, and as it turned out, it was broken. My parents were the only people who had a college education, except perhaps for my father's office assistant. He had a series of office assistants, and in fact, probably no one else had even been to high school. So My father had to serve as a kind of doctor sometimes for first aid. He was also deputy sheriff, and on one occasion he had to arrest somebody for stealing gold from the mining operations and send him to the penitentiary. Again, this had been a wide open mining camp back in the 1880s when the dredge, my father's dredge, dug through the center of town. It dug up hundreds of bullets and all kinds of jewelry, and one story which is true is that in one cleanup, every week or two, the collected gold deposits which had been separated out on the dredge were assembled and processed for delivery of a gold bar. In one cleanup, half a nickel was found. It had been cut in two by a hatchet, and in the next cleanup, the other half was found, which shows the thoroughness of the mining operation.
Has somebody written that period up?
No, I'd rather like to myself if I ever have time and can remember enough.
I know this. Are you going to say what your mother, how she managed, what she did?
Well,
was she writing then?
She was doing some writing. Of course, she was busy taking care of three children. Although there were, we did have some help from time to time. She played the piano. It must have been a very isolated life for her. Shall we turn it off for a moment? In the village of Murray, all eight grades were taught by one teacher in one room, and that's where I had my grammar school teaching. After the end of the first year, it was rather confused because I was taking reading with seventh grade and other subjects with other grades, and my parents were rather alarmed, and they kept me out of school for the next year. I don't know exactly how I spent my time in retrospect, except that I did a lot of hiking through the hills. We call them hills, they were really mountains. And I spent some time with an old prospector who was working two claims, and he would take me into the tunnels, and I would observe exactly how every aspect of the mining operation, which he and one other man were conducting, and always hoping to strike it rich.
You're six or seven at this point.
I was seven to eight. Then I didn't mix too well with the other children. I was very poor at sports.
Do you remember how you felt as a child at that point? Were you lonely, or?
No, I was undoubtedly somewhat lonely, yes. But the other children were not necessarily all all unintellectual. There was a neighbor boy who knew quite a lot about electricity, and at the age of 8 explained to me the difference between parallel and series circuits. later, I think he became quite successful in some kind of electrical work, but I have lost touch with all the people I knew then, except for one or two. I graduated after I reached the age of 11.
So they sent you back to the school?
Oh yes. After that uh-huh. one.
You probably helped teach some of the younger children, did you?
Possibly. I don't remember particularly. I did a lot of reading practically every book in the school library.
Uh-huh.
Then,
were you already interested in science at this point?
Not specially. That came the following year. I went to 3 different high schools, one in Washington, one in Idaho, and one in Oregon. They were, and I got extremely good instruction. The first two high schools had student bodies of only 100 and 200 respectively, but they had extremely good science laboratories. I feel that the quality of high school instruction must have deteriorated a lot since then.
This was in the mid-20s.
Mm-hmm. So I was in high school from 1923 to 1927.
Mm-hmm. You were sent off to these places and boarded, or
we lived. My mother and the children lived outside in a small town near Spokane, Washington, for my first 2 years of high school, and my sisters went to grade school. Mm,
this
there.
Was so you could go to
yes.
school.
Then we moved back to Murray, and in my junior year in high school, I had to board in the town of Wallace, which was the nearest high school, and stayed there through most of the winter, though occasionally I would come home for a weekend.
And how did you like that?
In one respect, not very well, because the place where I boarded with a family was a rather grubby place. The people were very nice. I took their meals there, took my meals, and also took piano lessons from the landlady. It was the only year in high school when I had a really good time with my fellow students, because Wallace, though a small city, was comparatively sophisticated, and I made a lot of friends and enjoyed some degree of social life, which I hadn't had before.
And were you yet interested in science, or what were your particular interests then?
Yes, I should go back a little. When I was, I guess, toward the end of my freshman year in high school, I read a book about chemistry and was immensely interested in it, and started accumulating a small laboratory at home, and did a lot of experiments, some of them involving chemicals which I certainly wouldn't want to have in my house now, my parents were quite tolerant about this.
What put you onto the book, do you remember?
I picked up every kind of book.
This is in the library.
Probably in the high school library. Oh. Yes. I became during my high school years interested in lots of other sciences. At one point, I read a lot about astronomy, and also, in my sophomore year, I taught myself enough Latin so that I could go into second year Latin in my junior year in high school.
What motivated you to do that?
I don't know. I was extremely interested in learning another language. In fact, at one point I started inventing my own, but I decided that it would be much more valuable to learn a real one. And
you chose Latin because your mother was...
Probably so, yes. Do you want to turn it off for a minute? Let me think for...
Well, I would like to. Were you interested in history and literature at that time?
To some degree, but not specially.
Can you say why you were interested? What got you interested in chemistry? I mean, you say the book aroused you, but why?
I can't really say. And I don't believe that there was anything especially attractive about chemistry. It might have been some other science.
Do you think it was the ability to take substances and change them?
I had a lot of fun with my own laboratory. Mm. There's one other book which probably influenced me. It's rather ridiculous. Someone had given me a book called 1001 Formulas by Sidney Gernsback, and it really did have 1,000 different things. It described all kinds of interesting things you could do with chemistry, electricity, mechanical devices, as sort of hobby exercises, and I used that a lot. For example, in manufacturing pyrotechnics is what I'm trying to say, various kinds of fireworks, again something which I wouldn't allow my children to do. I never took the high school course in chemistry. They told me that if I passed the exam and did one problem in the laboratory, they'd give me credit for it, which I did.
And did mm-hmm.
and,
do you think you missed anything by not taking it?
No. I'm a little ashamed of having passed the test. They gave me a compound which they wanted me to identify, and I knew the contents of most of the bottles in the high school laboratory, and I knew there was only one bottle that had little round pellets in it. So I guessed immediately what it was, and I ran two tests to prove it. And
well, if you knew all the bottles, you certainly probably should have passed the test.
On the other hand, I'm even more embarrassed about one other episode. I was allowed to go into the high school lab and set up some experiments just on my own to play around. And on one occasion, I neglected to clean up the mess afterwards, and the high school principal marched into the class that I was attending at that time and dragged me out. And I was really terribly ashamed.
And turn the tape.
Well, to explain why science appealed to me, I can only say that I was passionately interested in how things worked. And how anything technical worked. I'll backtrack on this a minute to say that just after I graduated from grammar school, I broke my arm rather severely, and I'm afraid this probably took a year off my father's life, because he was told I might never be able to use my arm again, and it affected him, I'm sure, much more than it did me. But I had to go to the city of Spokane and stay there for a month, with living with some family friends, I guess, to after I'd had it put together surgically, to have a physical therapist to restore the motion in the arm. And this was the first time I'd ever lived in the city. Spokane had a population of 100,000 at that time. First time I'd ever ridden on a streetcar, and I was extremely interested in how a streetcar operated. Went to the library and looked up. There were a series of correspondence school books where you could learn about things like that. And well, that's just an example of how
eager
I was to learn about anything technical. And of course, back in Murray, I knew everything about how a gold dredge operated.
That's right. You had had this,
yes,
this prospector.
And
your father.
The prospecting operation was fairly simple. It was just drilling holes in a rock wall and putting in dynamite and setting it off with fuses, and the next day shoveling up the muck, as it was called, and getting ready for extending the tunnel the next day. But the dredge was a highly complex piece of machinery, weighing 1,000 tons, floating in a pond which it digs and fills in behind itself with the tailings. And I knew everything about all the machinery in that in the dredge. Well, I graduated then from high school at the age of 15, and my parents took me out of school again because I was too young to go to college. So for a year, I worked mostly with my father. He was at that time prospecting a new mining claim, and then he constructed a dredge at this site. And I was a bookkeeper and typist, and during the prospecting I processed some of the gold analyses with very simple chemical equipment. And I taught myself a few other things. I taught myself enough German so that I could go into second year German in college, and also a little Russian. And
why did you pick on German and Russian?
Well, I don't know. If I'd known I was absolutely that I was going to major in chemistry, and if I realized that in those days you had to know German in order to study chemistry, it would have been a good idea. But perhaps it was because my mother had studied German. I don't know. I guess I don't have any other comments particularly about that year, unless you have some questions.
Well, I'm curious as to what you expected for yourself? Were you already, was it already decided that you'd go to Stanford?
Oh, yes. I think there was never any doubt that I would go to Stanford.
I see.
Yes, because both my parents had graduated from there.
Was it as difficult to get into? I'm sure you would have been able to get in anyway, but was
No,
was
it, wasn't, Stan- it wasn't as difficult.
Did you have any plan for yourself? For your future?
Not particularly, no. Excuse me, could you?
Have had?
No, I was fairly sure that I would do something in science or engineering, but I didn't have any specific goals.
I asked that because I once asked somebody, I mean, somebody once said that he did have, and so I don't think many people do at that age, but...
I wasn't at all sure whether I would, wasn't necessarily headed toward academic life.
You had had adequate training in math. You say you studied trigonometry. And
Yes. High schools didn't teach as much math then as they do now, but I'd had some kind of advanced algebra, I guess. Trigonometry I taught myself.
Yes.
When I got interested in astronomy, I had to learn trigonometry. I got a copy of the U.S. Nautical Almanac, which I thought was fascinating. And in the back of the almanac, in those days, there was a procedure for calculating an eclipse, so that for a given latitude and longitude, you could calculate just when the eclipse would begin and when it would finish by a very long process of trigonometry. Of course, there were no computers then.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an eclipse coming up, which would be visible at Stanford in 1929,
yes,
and I made
that
calculation, which I
that must have been thrilling.
Thoroughly enjoyed. It came out correct. I've never been an extremely good mathematician, though. I've had to use it in my work.
You must have really been very separate from your fellows, because you're so very much more advanced in your learning than anybody you knew could have been.
That was certainly true in high school. I always had a few friends, though, who had intellectual interests.
Mm.
And then, of course, as soon as I got to Stanford there, there were plenty of people.
There were?
Oh, sure. I wasn't.
I mean, it's not every, even subsequently distinguished person who's taught himself Latin and trigonometry. It seems to be rather unusual.
Maybe not. I found it quite easy to do. At Stanford, I took courses in both chemistry and engineering because I wasn't really sure which field I was going to go into, but I found that I liked the students in chemistry, and that perhaps was one reason for choosing that rather than engineering or physics, which might have been an alternative. I also took some far afield courses. I took an advanced course in German in Goethe's Faust. The class was conducted in German, and I made a detailed study of that play. I also took a course in philology. I was very much interested in languages, as you can guess, and this was a general course about languages, though not a go into the subject in great depth. Now I'll say something which I don't think I've commented on to anybody before. I graduated with a straight A average from Stanford, and I think I'm not sure whether I was the first to do so, but mm-hmm. there I guess hadn't been such a one for a long time, and I was always slightly ashamed of it because I thought that people would think I was some kind of a freak.
Oh yeah.
But a lot of people knew about it because the student directory in those days published for each person the number of credits and the number of grade points. So I suppose toward the end people were looking me up to see whether I'd...
Well, did it alienate people?
No, I don't think so. But I'm sure a lot of people did think I was a peculiar human being.
You had friends though at Stanford,
oh,
did you?
Oh yes, I had a lot of friends of different types. I graduated one quarter early because I'd been taking more credits than necessary throughout, and so I was actually a graduate student for the last 3 months of my stay at Stanford, and during my senior year, I did some undergraduate research. I was also a teaching assistant for the physical chemistry laboratory. Mm. The professor who regularly taught that was on sabbatical leave, and I pretty much ran the laboratory with nominal supervision by another physical chemistry professor.
Did this affect your interest in teaching? I mean, develop an interest in teaching? Or did you already have it?
Oh, I wasn't passionately interested in teaching, but I did enjoy doing this.
Did you have any outstanding teachers as an undergraduate that affected your choices?
Well. I don't think I had any highly stimulating teachers in science.
That's surprising.
I'm not one of these people who can look back and say this was the man who started me on.
That's so often the case.
Anything like that. Did have some interesting courses outside of science. I had two courses in history, which were taught by a man who was really kind of a clown, but he was very much interested in art, and I learned a lot about the Renaissance so when eventually I was in Italy, I was well prepared for art and architecture from having taken this course. Mm-hmm. Now,
well, you say the last 3 months you were in graduate, you were a graduate student, you must have already decided to go into graduate school and into chemistry.
I was sure that I would be a graduate student in chemistry somewhere. But something very strange came up at that point, and this is a rather long story, but as...
we have time.
Yes. There was a professor at Stanford named McBain who had been brought in from England as a distinguished professor, member, a fellow of the Royal Society. He was an international figure in colloid chemistry. He wasn't terribly well liked by the other faculty because he was rather pompous, and he had I didn't have any close association mm-hmm. with him particularly, though I took his course in college chemistry, I guess. He had, while in England, he'd had a student named Elford who joined the staff of the National Institute for Medical Research in London, and he developed a technique for studying viruses involving ultrafiltration through membranes. It wasn't a very elaborate technique. It involved making membranes with different porosities, and you could then judge the size of a virus, and nobody knew very much about viruses in those days, by finding the size of membrane through which the virus could not be filtered. Mm-hmm. And this created a lot of interest in the bacteriological and medical worlds. And a lot of people were going to this institute to learn how to make these membranes and use them. The Rockefeller Foundation wanted to have someone in the United States know about this technique, and they wrote to McBain saying, can you send one of your other students to work with Elford and then come back to this country? Professor McBain didn't have any graduate students who were interested in this sort of idea, and in desperation he latched on to me, though I was just getting my undergraduate degree, and he said, why don't you go to London and work there for a year or more and learn this technique. Well, it was a crazy thing because in the first place I wasn't interested in medical science and in the second place I wasn't mature enough to go and do research of this kind. Mm-hmm. But I thought maybe it's my only chance to go abroad. I was intensely interested in going to Europe. In my freshman year, I was looking forward to going to Europe someday. So in the end, I agreed. Huh. And funds were obtained then from the Rockefeller Foundation to send me over there. I was very concerned as to whether this was the best thing for me to do scientifically, yeah. and it's very doubtful as to whether it was, but I never look back and wish I'd done something else. That's as a matter of philosophy, I think that's a very unwise thing to do. I was not...
Oh, to look back, you mean,
yes,
regret.
I didn't say I wish I'd done something else. I never do that.
Yeah.
I was not in the slightest concerned about the idea of traveling a third of the way around the world and living in a foreign country. I was sure that I could do that easily, and I did. For the next...
Well... Yeah. But wait, before you get there, yeah. Had you developed an interest in a particular branch of chemistry as of that time?
No, and that was one of the things that worried me, and indeed it really took me a long time to settle on the exact work that I have concentrated on. Of course, polymer chemistry didn't exist then anyway, mm-hmm. But I didn't really know what I wanted to do.
That would be the lack of influence of a teacher, wouldn't it? Of
well,
a specific
not
teacher.
Necessarily. You focus attention. A teacher doesn't generally said you started on your specialty. That has to develop from individual interest, I would say. Well, not necessarily. Some of my students have stuck to what they did in graduate school and done very well at it. But, do you have any other questions at this point?
So, let's see. I'm just trying to think.
Yeah.
No, I haven't.
Yes. What time is it? I think we should stop about 11:30. But
it's 11:30.
Yes. Well,
can we just finish out this tape? It's got about 5 or 10
minutes
on it.
Oh, yes, certainly. So I was introduced to the medical community at a government laboratory. All the stationery had at the top OHMS, On His Majesty's Service. I settled down to learn how to make ultrafilter membranes and how to use them. It was a very different kind of scientific atmosphere. In the first place, nobody came to work until 10 o'clock in the morning.
Mrs. Elvium commented on this too when they went to England.
And the staff was divided into the white coats and the brown coats. The white coats were the professional staff, of whom I was one. Mm-hmm. The brown coats were the technicians who did a lot of the work. And we never fraternized with them. And I was embarrassed because middle-aged brown coats would always address me as sir at the end of every sentence. And here I was 20 years old
This is in 1933.
This is 1932.
32 yes. to 34. Yeah.
I asked at one point whether a brown coat could ever become a white coat.
Yeah.
And the answer was no, at least not in the same institution. But there were cases where a brown coat had gone to do graduate work in some other institution and eventually became a professional scientist, but some of the brown coats were considered it an immense privilege. In fact, there were stories about a brown coat who had wept because here he was being present at some critical experiment that he was participating in that would be very important for science. Mm-hmm. In later years, I'm sure those people became unionized, and when I was there, they were certainly exploited, I'd say.
And how did you, it bothered you because of your age?
Well,
did it bother you in other ways, too?
Well,
or did you get used to it?
I got used to it, certainly. I've never been the sort of liberal who agonizes over the tortures of the lower classes and so on. That didn't bother me particularly, but though I must say it bothered me a little when I would come into the lab at night and see scrub women on their hands and knees mopping the floors.
How did the white coats, how did you get along with the professionals?
Well,
being so young.
Most of them didn't know how young I was. In fact, I'll say a word about some of my duties. People did come from all over the world, including India and Japan, to learn this technique, and my job was to teach them how to do it, which wasn't very difficult. Uh-huh. But I met a number of very interesting people this way, and I also did some more basic work with the membranes, which Dr. Elford was interested in that wasn't applied to medicine.
Was this at his behest or
yes,
your?
Yes, at his behest. And we had a couple of papers about this. But the first publishable work that I did was with an Australian scientist who was working on a virus of some disease of chickens, and this led to a publication in the Journal of Bacteriology on the virus of Newcastle disease. This man, McFarlane Burnett, was later knighted and received the Nobel Prize.
Was he older than you were?
Oh, of course, yes. I'd say he was probably in his early 30s or something. Uh-huh. When I was 20. And later he came to Madison, and after he was Sir McFarlane Burnett, yeah. And we entertained him at our house, and when I mentioned how young I was when I was collaborating with him, he said, "Why, I thought I was working with a scientist and I was just working with a little boy."
So, was this very exciting for you? That's a leading question.
I'd say that the experience was very exciting. The science was not especially exciting.
Oh.
Indeed, it didn't contribute an awful lot to my scientific future, although I did learn about chemistry of proteins to a certain extent, and later on I was involved with proteins. Have you come to the end?
Yes.
Yes. Well, then maybe we should stop for today.
All right.
Well...